12:30 p.m. Eastern War Time. 660 on your dial. This is station WEAF, New York.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present From the Pacific. On this program, Monday through Friday each week, you hear NBC correspondents overseas. You listen to American fighting men in far distant places telling their experiences. Conducting the program, NBC commentator Wilson Foster, who not long ago brought you eyewitness accounts direct from Pacific battlefronts. Mr. Foster.
How do you do, everyone? Well, this is the period of worldwide high blood pressure as we await official word on Tokyo's declaration that she will accept the Potsdam Declaration. I'll sum up the situation briefly. At 5:37 this morning, Pacific wartime, Tokyo announced that the Japanese government had decided to accept the Potsdam Declaration with one stipulation, that Hirohito be allowed to remain. President Truman immediately called a meeting with cabinet members Burns, Stimson, and Forrestal. These gentlemen met for approximately 45 minutes, and at the end of that time made no disclosures other than they still had not received any official note from the Japanese government. Japan had indicated their acceptance to the Potsdam ultimatum and had been sent through neutral channels in Sweden and Switzerland. So now comes the period of waiting. How long it will take for the Allied powers to reply to Japan, no one knows. It shouldn't take over 48 hours. Truman, Burns, Stimson, and Forrestal have probably tentatively set America's reply already. Great Britain's reply will come from Prime Minister Clement Attlee, Russia's reply from Premier Stalin, and China's reply from Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. The United States will not make any independent reply to the Japanese offer. There will have to be complete agreement among the big four powers before the war will end. But of this we feel certain today, that Japan's offer will be accepted. First, for this reason, the Potsdam ultimatum made no mention of the emperor, although it did say stern justice would be meted out to all war criminals. Well, this brings us back to the question, is the emperor a war criminal? Just how responsible has he been for Japanese atrocities? But right now, From the Pacific takes you across the seas, and let's go there for a reaction report from the island of Guam. Come in, George Thomas Folster.
This is George Thomas Folster on Guam. It is now 2:30 in the morning out here, and a little more than 4 hours ago, the first rumors began to circulate. Rumors that Japan had accepted the Potsdam ultimatum. A night watch stander rushed up saying, "It's all over. I just heard it on the radio." I want you to know the enlisted man's reaction to this momentous news. So I am turning this microphone over to Harvey Twyman, combat correspondent for the Coast Guard, who has rounded up some of his shipmates. Harvey has 4 D-Day landings under his belt, including Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and was making preparations for the next invasion. Harvey, take it from here.
Here with me in the studios are 3 other Coast Guardsmen, John Papson, photographer's mate from Birmingham, Michigan, Martin Burke from New Orleans, and Coast Guard Chief Specialist Gerald McCann from Boston. Chief, when did you first hear of the action by Japan?
Sometime after 10 o'clock. The lights were out in the barracks area. Radios are supposed to be off, too, but ours was on, as usual. Someone remarked the Guam station was working overtime. Then about 10:30, the dance music was interrupted by a short announcement. A couple of chiefs started yelling, "Hey, listen to this." I yelled, "Pipe down so we can hear what he's saying." As soon as we were sure that Japan had accepted the terms, everybody in the hut started yelling and cheering and pounding each other on the back. I ran across the street to my skivvy to wake up a friend of mine, but he was awake. Everybody was. Even the guys about to go on watch in an hour or so.
What was your personal reaction?
Well, it wasn't even a surprise. Ever since the atomic bomb and the Russian declaration, I've been expecting this. I took bets on it. One man said it was a matter of months. I said days. When he came up tonight to pay me, he said he was never so happy to pay a buck in all his life.
How much was it, Jerry?
$10. But you know, Harvey, I think it's a shame that President Roosevelt isn't alive to hear this.
Yes, it is, Jerry. What are your post-war plans?
Well, first I'd like to figure a way of going back to the States around the other way, through India.
I hope you make it. Now, here's another Coast Guardsman, John Papson. His family lives in Birmingham, Michigan, just outside Detroit. John is a combat photographer for the Coast Guard. He's made pictures of the assault troops landing at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. John, where were you when you heard the news tonight?
Well, we just came back from motion picture. It was an exceptionally good show, and we sat in our hut discussing the show and performance. That was around 10 o'clock. I was undressed when we were back. Some of our fellows were still fixing their mosquito nets and spraying their hut. The lights were out, and the radio station had just signed off. I guess I must have fallen asleep, because the next thing I knew, I heard a lot of yelling from the hut next to ours. We all jumped out of our sacks and ran to the other hut. We heard the news on their radio.
What was the reaction in the hut when you heard the news?
Well, the place was a madhouse. Besides the usual occupants of the hut, all of our gang were in there also, and everybody talking at once.
What was the talk about?
Well, they were wondering if the Allies would accept the terms, and it was finally decided that Japan wasn't asking for too much in regard to the emperor. This term should be accepted, though.
Okay, John, thanks to you. Now here's Coast Guardsman Martin Burke from New Orleans. He was out here in one of the first LSTs to come from the States when we were working on a shoestring. He was in the Elisa's before Tarawa and in the Solomons at the time of Bougainville. Then he came out again on another LST and made Iwo Jima. Martin, when did you first hear the news tonight?
Well, we were all turned in for the night about 4 hours ago, around 10 o'clock. We heard somebody outside the hut talking about the Japanese peace terms. As soon as I heard it, I had a sinking feeling in my stomach. And I thought there wasn't any use getting worked up about it. Everybody in the hut felt the same way. They said, no, it's just a rumor. But the longer I lay there, the worse I got. And I finally decided to come up to headquarters to find out if it was true. I started to drive up, got in the truck. Half the men in my hut climbed in with me. They couldn't take it either.
How do you suppose your wife feels about this news, Martin?
I imagine she's as happy as I am. We've only been married a year, and I've been overseas 10 months of that time. So we've got a honeymoon to resume.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. There you are, Coast Guardsmen at Guam, electrified tonight by the news from Japan, and already planning their return to the States. This is Harvey Twyman of the Coast Guard. I return you to NBC San Francisco.
Thank you, Guam. We like to view the current situation as realistically as possible. Now we bring you the words of a man who knows the Japanese, knows war at its very worst. NBC's Bert Silvan, who only 5 months ago returned to the United States after 37 months in a Jap internment camp in the Philippines. Mr. Silvan.
It is hard to realize that before this day is over, the war with Japan and all war may well be finished and done with. Those of us who spent years under the dominating power of the Japanese military better appreciate, I think, what it means to us and to the world to end once and for all that terrifying influence. Japan's condition of surrender, if it is a condition, that Emperor Hirohito be allowed to retain his throne, could well be in line with the Allied plans for the future of Japan. I believe that Hirohito could be a stabilizing influence in bringing Japan back to a peaceful and democratic nation. Many people, no doubt, have given the Japanese emperor too much credit as the instigator and leader of the Jap war effort. If we can think of the emperor in the same terms as we do of the King of England, for example, we must realize that despite his unique role as a religious as well as the titular head of the Japanese people, he has been completely subjugated to the will and the power of the warlords, we can better evaluate his real position. To eliminate the emperor would be tantamount to banning the Japanese religion. This in itself would be contrary to our principle of freedom of religion. Ideally, of course, would be the proposition of divorcing church and state. But just how that could be accomplished under such a complex setup as now exists in Japan would be one of the major problems of our peace table conferees. Be that as it may, the offer of Japan, if it be a valid one, to accept the Potsdam terms can mean only one thing. Japan is ready to quit. And the one request to save the emperor should not present an insurmountable problem. Every minute counts now. It counts heavy in men and money. We spent $2 billion to perfect the atomic bomb. We are spending about $200 million a day to carry on this war. If this bomb, as it no doubt has shortened the war for even 10 days, the project has paid for itself in dollars and cents. But 10 days of shortened warfare means more than all the money in the world. It means the saving of thousands of lives. Every 2 minutes of the day and night, some American boy is killed or wounded while the war goes on. That is why I say that minutes count. We must be resolved, however, that despite any cost of men and money, we will not and cannot accept any terms from Japan short of unconditional surrender. If, in any sense of the word, Japan's offer does not meet with our aims and ideas of unconditional surrender, then I am sure that every real American, yes, even our people who are right now in the hands of the Japs in military or civilian prison camps, would say, America, fight on.
Thank you, Bert Silvan. Once again, let's pick up reaction, this time in the Philippines. We switch you now to Merrill Muller in Manila.
This is Merrill Muller reporting from Manila. Japan, on the threshold of decision, finds surrender is her only escape from annihilation. The Tokyo radio reports heard here today created intense excitement among those I have talked to. Coupled with the extraordinary meeting in the Suzuki cabinet, it appears Japan has reached the end of her world and is preparing herself internally for exposure to Western justice. The bomb at Pearl Harbor has ricocheted into Harakiri for the Japan we have known in current affairs. One way or another, it is a new Japan that the United Nations are now facing. In all this hubbub of excitement, one man calmly studies the latest reports here and puts his notes and background together for the answers. He is General MacArthur's G2, our Chief of Intelligence, the department that knows all about the enemy. Major General Charles Willoughby is a turn-hard, regular army officer of German descent. His father was a former field general of the German army, but General Willoughby was taken from Germany when still a youth and settled in Pennsylvania under his American mother's name years ago. A four-language linguist, he has studied in the best military schools of America and Europe and served with distinction in the First World War, Latin America, on Bataan, and on MacArthur's staff since. Once an army instructor at Fort Leavenworth, he wrote a number of professional journals. General Willoughby, decorated several times for bravery and ability against the Japanese, is wary of the enemy and very suspicious. The Jap is like a maddened, wounded beast, he says, and fights hardest when cornered in a hopeless situation. The Jap army could afford, he adds, to lose 20 divisions per year and not weaken. They love such losses, General Willoughby says, as national military honor. The public, once used to it, and did eat it up. But those words, the public, is the catch line, the general adds with emphasis. The ability of Japan to wage war depended on the public to offer up funds for the fighting forces and weapons for those forces to use. Ordinary bombing reduced weapon production, but now there is the atomic bomb, and the whole situation has changed. The atomic bomb wipes out not only the factories, homes, and services of the public, but it kills in large numbers the very spinal column of any nation's war effort, all strata of population. The Japanese public may have been prepared to suffer large losses among the fighting personnel, but it isn't ready to accept deaths and casualties among its own ranks by the atomic bomb. Every declaration of Radio Tokyo since the bombing of Hiroshima bears that out. The Japs, psychologically, are at the quitting point. The latest and most complete report here of the Radio Tokyo surrender appeal is that emanating from army radio trucks touring Manila streets. It's 1:30 in the morning out here, and men are still screaming, yelling, and trying to celebrate. Military police quietly are herding the men back to their camps after these cheering and shooting sprees with the admonition to wait until it's all official. To help the MPs with this control plan, Army loudspeaker trucks, gab wagons as the GIs call them, are touring the streets and telling the soldiers all the developments as known here by the local Office of War Information. The radio truck, which just went by the office, reported to the men in the street, and I quote, Radio Tokyo has announced Japan will surrender in accordance with the Potsdam ultimatum, provided the Japanese emperor remains as head of the Japanese people. There is absolutely no official confirmation of this peace offer. Washington is studying a proposal which reached the Allied government through diplomatic channels, but this also is very unofficial, unquote. You can imagine what that means to these GIs out here as they see victory and a near home possibility at last after the long and stinking trail through the jungle islands of MacArthur's comeback road across the Pacific. And now back to the NBC newsroom in San Francisco.
Thank you, Merrill Muller. A big question. What's going to happen if we don't accept Japan's surrender ultimatum? Now for an answer to that question, here's veteran NBC correspondent Robert McCormick.
Well, Bud, if the Japs aren't serious about surrendering, and if they are, but we won't take them seriously, I'm afraid we're really in for it. I think we'll have one of the weariest, most drawn-out, most deadly wars of all history on our hands. The Japs obviously are already whipped, but we saw what they did on Saipan and Tinian and Guam and Iwo and Okinawa after they were whipped. And I think we'd have a large-scale repetition of these smaller battles. I suppose every last miserable Jap soldier would continue to fight with guns, rocks, sticks, and his bare hands until he was killed or until he starved to death.
Well, thank you very much, Robert McCormick. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes NBC's report from the Pacific for today. This is Wilson Foster speaking from San Francisco. From the Pacific comes to you from San Francisco. This is the National Broadcasting Company.